Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the donate tab. And so this kind of transitions pretty well into what I wanted to talk about tonight. I wanted to talk a little bit about the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of mind. In particular, I want to talk about maybe even beyond the third foundation, talk about perceptions and thoughts. I find that there are three different levels of observing the mind in meditation. One is pretty subtle. It's observing the attitude or the mood or emotion of the mind. And so throughout our day, looking at, the mind that has anticipation, or the mind that has craving, or the mind that has resistance, the mind that has lethargy, the mind that has restlessness, the mind that has doubt. These are all like attitudes and moods. And some of these even have an emotional or physical quality. And the Buddha calls these mind states, mindfulness of mind states. This has been huge for my practice, and even just being able to see how much my environment affects my mood throughout the day. Like the sun came out today, and I went over to get a smoothie, which is probably a result of the sun being out. And I was at the smoothie place. I got out of my car and the sun was shining. I was like, man, I feel really fucking good. I was like, I love Nashville. My whole outlook on, my life changed dramatically just because of the mood, and so looking at the mood and the mind, and how even moods are impermanent throughout our day. Our moods change, right? And to try to not really get too identified with our moods, because just like conditions in our lives change, our moods and our attitudes change. We can't always have a optimistic, positive attitude, Sometimes difficult things happen and we have a frustration or, sadness or anger or something like that arise into the mind. So that's mindfulness of mind states. And the two I wanted to focus more on tonight is mindfulness of thought patterns. The way that I'm going to call this tonight is the stories of the mind, the kind of content of what we're thinking about. Some of the categories of thoughts might be like plans, planning, or remembering, comparing, fantasizing. So those are different kind of thought habits or patterns. And then there's even a more subtle element of thinking that, or of mind, I should say, that involves something that's more immediate, and we would call that perception. And that's what I want to start talking about, is perception. Perception is an automatic mental labeling or organizing of experience. So the Buddha said that perception is present in every mind moment. So every moment that we're conscious or aware, there's perception. And so the mind knows things or is able to label and organize things based on past experience and based on having sensory organs. So having, some of us have different varieties of ability or capacity for these sensory organs, but having sight, sound, feeling, being able to have perception means that we can make sense of the world and we can organize and we can learn. So the definition of perception is the organization, identification, and interpretation of sensory information in order to represent and understand the presented information or the environment. So I'll read it one more time. It's very dry, but I think it has a lot to offer. It's the organization, identification, and interpretation of sensory information in order to represent and understand the presented information in the moment or the environment. So the important thing to say about perception, this is really what the Buddha is most interested in, is that perception is automatic and not always accurate. And so we misperceive experiences in the present and our interpretations of experiences. And there have been a couple like pop psychology, like social media examples of this with like the Yanny and Laurel. I don't know if y'all remember that. It's like Hello 2015 or whenever that was. But the kind of like sound of hearing, some people heard the word Yanny and some people heard the word Laurel. And then there was the whole like viral the dress. It's like, is it black and blue or is it gold and white? Yeah. And so these are kind of ridiculous because they're pop, viral, you know, creations of our social subconscious. But this is a matter of perception, right? It really points to how we see things differently, even the same thing. Even how the light hits something can make us see something in two different ways. And so if we're perceiving all the time, right, and we only really have a limited field of perception, then we often misperceive. Another interesting thing about perception is our perception is conditioned, the Buddha says. So how you see the world and what you see and how, especially in perception, how you interpret the world is largely based upon past experiences you've had or cultural and social conditioning or familial kind of values and understandings of the world. And so we often react to present experiences based on perceptions that are not accurate, but are also based on previous experiences. And a lot of times, like in psychological terms, we talk about transference or projection. Like sometimes when you meet someone and we maybe have limited information about who they are, or haven't really gotten to know them yet, we may already have a story or kind of an attitude about the person. We may already kind of orient ourselves to that person in a particular way, defensive, right? Or they feel warm and inviting. And sometimes we misperceive people. And so it's just interesting to notice, and what I'm going to talk about tonight is to work with perception in a way that's direct and immediate by using mindfulness. So I want to share just a little story. I've told it here before a couple times about perception. And in this story, I was on a retreat for a month in New Mexico. And I was at a retreat center called Vallecitos, which is in the middle of the Carson National Forest. It's unlike any place I've ever been, especially any retreat center. It's very wild. As a matter of fact, the name of the retreat was Rewilding the Mind. And the kind of homage of this center, Wild Heart, kind of is a throwback to that experience. And so we're out in the wild. I'm staying in a tent. There's one place that everyone sits and meditates. It's a meditation hall about this big. And that's pretty much the only like closed building you can go in. And the rest is just this huge forest. And so when we would do walking meditation, I'd walk way out into the woods. And, you know, we'd have like an hour to do walking meditation. So just walk back and forth. And one day I was out in the woods, I was walking back and walking forth, and all of a sudden I turn around and I see this wolf coming through the trees and staring at me. So you know, like sometimes when wild animals like see you and you see them, they stop. And so this wolf was kind of like coming out of the woods, and I was turning my meditation, my walking meditation, very slowly. I was turning, I turn around, and I see this wolf, and it stops, and I stop, and we just look at each other. And I was just overwhelmed with emotion. I was like, oh shit, I'm with this wolf, you know, I don't know what to do in this situation. I was like, all of a sudden my mind cycling through like all the survival shows I watched, and I was like, do you play dead? Do you scream? Like, do you try to run? Like, what's the wolf's thing? Like, how are they going to kill me, right? And so I'm thinking about all this stuff, and then I'm like, shit, you're just thinking, and this wolf, and it's like this wolf staring at you. And then I was like, all right, I'm just going to turn around and slowly walk away. And so I just start turning around very slowly, and I start walking away, and all of a sudden I hear the like huffing breath. And it's like, you know, when something happens, if you've ever been in a car accident or something, it's like time slows down. This whole situation is probably like 4 seconds. But I turned around and I heard this just, and I hear this thing jump up behind me, and I turn around and it licks my hand. And it was someone's dog. And the person came out of the woods and yelled for their dog, and their dog went back to them, and I was just like, I didn't know, because it's a silent retreat, like whether I should share with the person how freaked out I was. I probably looked crazy.
Do you have to do
your— Say what?
You have to go do your laundry.
No comment. No, not quite. But it was a matter of perception, right? Just seeing in this moment what I perceived to be a wolf, which was a dog. And the thing here that was so astounding to me is how much emotion and how much story and how much thought just automatically arose from this perception. And how as soon as the dog licked my hand and I heard the jingling of its collar once it got right next to me, how much my attitude shifted immediately. And so the purpose of mindfulness, of meditation, from the Buddhist perspective, is to cultivate a realistic perception of the world, to see things as they are. The Buddha even says that what we're trying to do, or what his quest for awakening helped him to develop, was a way to see the world immediately and directly. And so there's this meditation master, I talked about this yesterday, named Sayadaw Utejaniya, and he likes to kind of do this like dad joke with his students. And he comes into the meditation hall, you know, and says, is Buddhism a pessimistic religion or an optimistic religion? And then he laughs and slaps his knee and he says, it's a realistic religion. Because Buddhism's not about ideology. It's not about believing in things. It's not about trying to see things in an idealistic way, or even a pessimistic or nihilistic way. It's trying to see things as they are. Mindfulness connects us more intimately with our human condition to see, yeah, this is the mind. This is what it's like in this moment. This is the body. To see things how they are in actuality means that sometimes we have more awareness of what's difficult. You know, that this mind craves pleasure, it wants comfort, it wants security, it wants the world to be predictable and certain, and the world is not those things all of the time. And so learning how to practice this kind of radical acceptance of things the way they are means just coming into the experience and saying, as Ajahn Sumedho says, right now it's like this. This is how it is in actuality. And when we argue with reality, that's when we suffer. Or when we misperceive things as they are and we react to things based on our projections, we suffer. And so if we can practice just cultivating more awareness throughout the day, we have more accurate data. I like to think about mindfulness as this kind of like data collection. And I like that because in science, there's not supposed to be this kind of like opinion about the data, right? There's just supposed to be this is what it is. This is what the experiment gave us. These are the results. This is what we can empirically observe in the moment. And so the purpose of meditation is to cultivate wise view, which is the first of the Eightfold Path factors. To see that experience is impermanent. And when we cling to things that are changing, we suffer. When we cling to this body that will age, we suffer about aging. When we cling to this mind that's clear and youthful and so intelligent, has such great memory, we suffer. And when we cling to our relationships and our partners, you know, and the people that we meet in relationships change. Who we are as a self is not a noun, it's a verb. We are changing. And when we cling to people being a certain way, when I cling to myself, identity, who I am, I suffer. And so the more that we see things as they are and we're with the flow of change and we're able to kind of practice in Zen, they call this the beginner's mind, you know, waking up anew each moment with curiosity and wonder. That's the aspiration, at least, because sounds impossible. Sometimes in my Western mind, I'm like, I'll never be able to do that. Right, but when I aspire to look at everything brand new with a beginner's mind, you know, I'm able to live more in line with how things are. This is perception, something to reflect on. The other thing I want to talk about is the power of thoughts. So these are more the stories that the mind creates. There's another meditation teacher, one of Joseph Goldstein's teachers, Menindraji, who said that if you want to understand the mind, you have to sit down and watch it. Our thoughts are so powerful. Because beyond perception, how we see or label or organize the world, how we make sense of the world, that's what we call our thoughts, right? The stories that kind of are running. And we've all had moments, and this is something that maybe is beautiful about the Dharma, is that the Dharma is something that hopefully you've already experienced. There's not new information here, but we've all had moments where we've told ourselves a story, maybe for years, about who we are, or how we're doing, or who we should be. And those stories, maybe not in a sudden moment, but over time, start to change. And our worldview, our story about who we are and what our purpose is, has an ability in those moments of awareness to start to adapt. I think one of the stories, the Western kind of American dream, is this story of us having some singular purpose. And I find the millennial generation, my generation, plagued by this the remnants of maybe the 50s and 60s, where things were very societally different in the U.S. And because things change, right? The kind of career, the one-time life career with benefits and pension, those jobs aren't as available as they were. And so I do a lot of work with young people, and I've talked a little bit and given some presentations on doing therapy with millennials. And one of the things that I see is this kind of this story that we all have some one purpose, right? Like we're supposed to be somebody. And that I really think that if we are really looking at ourselves and our lives, we have so many purposes to so many people. You know, even in simple ways, like we play roles at work, we're supportive to friends, we have a spiritual self, we have an intellectual self, a creative self, a social self, you know. And these are all purposes. These are all things that we can find meaning in. But sometimes our stories come in and say, yeah, but I haven't become who I need to be yet. Munindraji says, if you want to understand the mind, we have to sit down and watch it. So looking at the stories of the mind and looking at how powerful they are and how they construct our worldview is a part of what we're doing. I read this quote yesterday, Bhikkhu Bodhi, a Buddhist scholar. I'm big on the monastics these days. I think I've already quoted four tonight. He says, our thoughts govern our attitudes, our actions, and our whole orientation to the world we live in. Our thoughts might not be clearly formulated in our mind. We might only have a hazy conceptual grasp of them. But whether they're formulated or not, expressed or maintained in silence, these thoughts have a far-reaching influence. They structure our perceptions, order our values, and crystallize into the frameworks through which we interpret ourselves, the meaning of our being in the world. And this has been a lot of the work that Brené Brown has done, and probably why she is very popular in the West, is because she researches shame. This is, I think, by large, a Western phenomenon, shame. Feeling unworthy and incapable. I remember having this feeling on a retreat recently. It was so powerful because on retreat, your mind quiets down and you can start to really look into the depths of some of these stories and some of these feelings like shame. And I had this feeling of shame come up that didn't even have a story. It didn't even have a mental component, but it was a feeling that I got. And I was sitting in this group, and one of my heroes, Ajahn Sachido, this monk, he's been a monk for 40 years, was teaching, and we were nearing the end of the retreat, and some of the participants just started sharing their love for him and just gratitude. Because monks don't teach for money or for personal gain because they don't own anything. So he came all the way out, you know, from England and taught this retreat. And, you know, he's just there for the love of the Dharma, just to teach. He's going to go back home to his two pairs of robes and, you know, monastic life, secluded life. And so all these people were just sharing all of their gratitude and love. And I had this feeling that I was sitting like just right outside of that love, like I was just kind of not included in it. And it was so powerful to see that. I was like so grateful for that awareness because it's something that's so familiar for me, but it's like so hard to see, you know, it's so hard to be aware of. And I was able to notice this kind of like sense of shrinking back. I literally had this feeling because I was sitting on, you know, one of the sides of the room, like there was this force field and everyone was sharing gratitude and I was just right outside of it. Brené Brown talks a lot about shame and about the stories of shame. She calls this part of the mind the inner hustler. She said it's always trying to compare and compete and outperform and prove. She said that shame, this voice, has a fear-based, or it has a fear, and a shame-based fear, that's what she says. It has a shame-based fear. The inner hustler has a shame-based fear of being ordinary. That's what she says. The inner hustler has a shame-based fear of being ordinary. And so a lot of our kind of thoughts, the stories of our mind, just construct our worldview and our sense of self, of who we are and how we're doing. And our stories also construct our external world, what we believe about other people and their intentions and motivations and who they are as people.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, sure.
At what point, like, what's the difference between stories that we tell ourselves or that we listen to versus when that becomes delusion? Where's that line? Is it just when we start to distort reality, or because isn't stories distorting reality?
Well, so that's a great question, probably a great discussion. Maybe that can be one of the prompts for the discussion later too, because there's a lot, right? That's something to investigate for sure. So we'll come back to it if we don't, remind me. Our stories of other people tend to materialize, and just like my stories of myself are often kind of unchecked. And sometimes they talk about this on retreat as well. And it's also a really great environment when you're sitting a meditation retreat to watch your stories and judgments about other people, mostly because you're not talking to them. So it's very apparent that it's a story that your mind made up. And so you can't really get too lost in the projection, because the mind is just... You never even talked to that person. You're 6 days, 7 days into a retreat, and you just created this whole story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the loud breather, the loud person. It's like, don't they have any respect for what we're trying to do here? It's like this oaf just walking around, stomping their feet, totally unmindful, probably not even benefiting from the retreat. I don't even know why they're here. You know, some of the stories and judgments are just ridiculous. Exactly. Well, sometimes I've heard a teacher say that, getting stuck in traffic, and how we rarely realize that we're a part of the traffic. It's a good reflection. People have stories about us too, right? And that's just their mind. And so some of our stories around emotions can be really strong too. Like I talked about shame, and the stories that come out of shame, but also the stories that come out of loneliness. It's one of my favorite topics. It's something that's been very dear to my heart my whole life. And a lot of my loneliness stories are some of the most convincing. I've been in recovery for 13 years, and for a good portion, probably 4 or 5 years of my early recovery, I wasn't in a relationship. And I had a lot of anxiety and low self-esteem and just nervousness for a lot of years in early recovery. And I remember really wanting to have a relationship or be in one, but just being so terrified at what I would have to overcome. And so I was in this place where I just felt stuck, and my friends were, you know, dating people or had a new boyfriend, girlfriend, or partner every other month. I just remember how strong the loneliness story was. This kind of view that I'm always going to be alone. And how powerful it is when we practice mindfulness to be able to just name and note these experiences. It's just the mind thinking. It's just a mind that really cares about us and wants for us to be happy, but is maybe thinking that our happiness is dependent on something that we're not, instead of trying to find a deeper abiding sense of happiness and being able to just open to the experience and be with the loneliness. And one of the community members in here and I have talked about this before, is like, when with mindfulness I learned how to be with my loneliness, the loneliness was no longer alone. Right? It's like I could actually sit with it and say, oh, loneliness, I feel you, I care about you, I'm here for you. And the more that I got to know that emotion, in some way all the stories just started to kind of reduce. They started to lessen. When I could be with the primary feeling, I didn't have to go into this secondary story. And this is really powerful. It's almost easy to overlook, but a really powerful part of practicing mindfulness of feeling is learning how to allow ourselves to be with that underlying sinking feeling in the gut, right? Or being with the nervous energy in the chest, or the hot anger in the arms and around the chest, or the kind of cold shame and that feeling of shrinking back. And when we're able to be with these emotions in this way, we don't have to get so caught up in these extra levels of story. In therapy, psychotherapy, one form of psychotherapy, they call this parts work. And I like this because it's like we have these parts, these emotional parts of ourselves that they just need some presence and awareness. And if we can learn how to be with them, we can learn how to nurture them and almost parent them in a way with our awareness, then they don't act out as much. It's like a little kid. All they really want sometimes is just attention. And so play with that and maybe see if that's something that resonates for you. Talking a little bit more about stories, there's a poet named Muriel Rukeyser who says that the universe is made of stories, not atoms. And the Buddha talks about this too. He says that in this fathom-long body with its thoughts and perceptions lies the world, the origin of the world, the ending of the world, and the path that leads to the ending of the world. And so what he's saying is that, what is the path that leads to the ending of the world? It's the path that leads to the ending of these stories. Because our world is constructed, as he says, in this fathom-long body with its thoughts and perceptions. In this path, right, what he's saying is that also in this body, with its thoughts and perceptions, is the end of that world. Not that we rid ourselves of thoughts or perceptions, but these worlds that can get constructed, these stories of self. I want to talk just a moment about, oh, let me say real quick, Brené Brown has a great quote. She says that without active awareness, the mind doesn't take responsibility for its stories, nor does it have any interest in writing new endings for them. Without active awareness, the mind doesn't take responsibility for its stories, nor does it try to write new endings for them. So active awareness, mindfulness. I want to look at a couple more things and then we'll open it up for discussion. And these are maybe just some more practical ways of working with different kinds of patterns of thoughts. And the first one is what I call narrow-mindedness, or sometimes they call it magnification or black and white thinking or either or all or nothing type of thinking. So it's kind of when our thought patterns are very limiting or reductionary. I think one of the things I'm noticing in our social environment, as you know, there becomes more demand to change some of the kind of systems of oppression and some of the remnants that haven't yet been resolved from the first stage of the civil rights movement. As we start to look into, you know, being more socially connected through social media and technology, and you know, our political views and worldviews are just being thrown up onto each other. One of the things I notice for myself, and I think in the social arena, is that we've kind of lost a taste for complexity. You know, and this, I think we sometimes have these two responses when our views are, you know, being presented, or when we're hearing other people's views, is one, we either start to kind of try to figure out where we stand, and we kind of move into our familiar territory. It's like we kind of really get into the arena of the people that are in our camp, and we just kind of move into the corner with them. Or we become apathetic and indifferent. Oh, it's too complex to even talk about. Just forget about it. Too much, all this politics and race and feminism and patriarchy is just too much. And so we tend to kind of become, I think, overwhelmed by the complexity. And we think we either have to take a stand or we have to just get out. And one of the things that mindfulness has really helped me to do to be a more engaged person is to try to practice like lingering in experiences that challenge my fixed views. So like really as a mindfulness practice, and I mean even like you know this is going to happen like probably this week where someone's going to come to you with some view that you probably disagree with, like see what that's like to be in that experience, to kind of linger in the experience. And I don't mean if it's a view that maybe comes with like a threat to your safety, that's a different situation. Maybe don't linger in that. But if it's a view, you know, if it's a conversation or something with a friend or family member or coworker, it's a great opportunity to linger into experiences that challenge our fixed views, to see what the emotional pull is. And another thing that I like to practice is the kind of Socratic questioning. Socrates was so great at arguing, and it's something I've shared about in here before too. I think he was also very problematic, as a lot of the ancient classical philosophers were, but by today's standards. But he was really great at arguing because he would always ask questions. And so when he was in an argument with someone as challenging his own views and stories, he would say, well, do you mean this or do you mean that? And he would give them an opportunity to kind of explain themselves. And he would just continue to do that over and over again. And what you would find in a lot of these kind of like ancient philosophical rhetoric is that eventually Socrates and the people he was arguing with would come pretty close to the same thing, but there would be some just kind of inherent differences. And once they got down to that point, he could argue his point, right? They could kind of get to a place where they could actually have a conversation. But he spent all this time first just asking questions like, well, do you mean it this way or that way? Or tell me more about, you know, what you're saying right now. So questioning has been something that's been helpful, being kind of lingering in the not knowing, also being able to say, I don't know. You know, having this beginner's mind and saying, huh, that's interesting. I don't feel like I really agree with that. I'm not quite sure why yet. Give me a moment. The Buddha said that nothing leads to human suffering more than clinging to fixed views. And he said that there are two things that support wise view. Continuous awareness, mindfulness, lingering in experience, being present, aware, observant, objective, non-judgmental. So continuous awareness and the words of a wise friend. Another thing that helps me to challenge some of my stories, not just my views about politics or the world, but also my views about myself, is other people. Right? I had a friend call me today, and he's been kind of going through a lot of stuff, and was just talking about how, you know, like we do sometimes, he felt he just hadn't made progress in a particular area of his life because it's something that keeps coming up. And I was able to help him challenge that and say, well, you know, I think we're going to be dealing with what you're talking about the rest of our lives. And it doesn't mean you haven't made progress just because you're experiencing it again. Being able to have friends that are able to kind of challenge, and also to challenge us in maybe sometimes more of a way that we don't want to be challenged. You know, being able to hold us accountable, and, you know, and to help us to kind of learn and re-experience or re-evaluate our views. So another thing that helps with narrow-mindedness is just mindfulness that helps us to synthesize or integrate extremes. I call this the both and. Like when I'm experiencing a uncomfortable feeling in meditation practice, like maybe it's a pain in my knee or something, it's interesting to notice, and it doesn't mean that the pain goes away, but it's interesting to notice that there are other parts of the body that aren't in pain. And to be able to just notice, oh, my hand is actually quite calm feeling and relaxed feeling, and the sounds are maybe quite wide and spacious feeling, and the, you know, stomach and the chest are maybe a little bit expansive or open right now. And so we call this a whole body perspective. It's like, or what in Zen they might call big mind, or in our lineage or tradition they maybe call big sky. Jack Kornfield has a meditation called Big Sky Mind, which is just where we can kind of look at things, and what is the Buddha is really encouraging us to do is to create this wise view that life is both equally beautiful and tragic. And so sometimes I like to challenge myself almost as a thought experiment, and when I'm caught up in just the kind of cynicism and skepticism and negativity, I'll just kind of remind myself, I'll be like, I'm not in wise view right now. Like, I'm just really looking at one aspect of experience. And it's real. It doesn't invalidate what I'm seeing. It's like something that's difficult. But that there's also other things, too. And we don't have to discredit or invalidate the difficult by opening to other things. And one way that I like to describe this, really great Dharma teacher, Matthew Brensilver, says that for every one thing that's true, something else is also true. So it's just a good practice. Like sometimes when something is true and I'm noticing it in the moment, I'm able to just be like, all right, what else is also true here? So narrow-mindedness. And the last two I'll just kind of mention and we'll open it up. The other is what I call lawyer mind. And lawyer mind is the mental habit to gather evidence for the symptoms of one's distress. So that means when you're tripping, your mind's going to look around and try to figure it out. Why am I tripping? Is it my relationship? And it's going to start analyzing your relationship. Is it my job? It's going to start analyzing your job. Is it, you know, me? Uh-oh, analyzing me. And so the lawyer mind is always just trying to find the cause of every feeling. And sometimes feelings don't really have like a direct cause, right? They're sometimes the result of a complex set of circumstances. Like one thing I learned early in recovery is the hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Sometimes it's just the physiological aspect, and then there's maybe your boss said something to you and, it, you know, your attachment traumas came up and you're feeling like you're gonna not have a job on Monday, and you didn't sleep well last night, you haven't eaten anything, like, right? And the lawyer mind is just trying to analyze your whole life and say, well, let me tell you why you feel the way you do, because you're bad. Or because your relationship shit, or because whatever. And the last one is rumination, which is the habit of mind to compulsively focus attention on the symptoms of one's distress. So instead of gathering evidence, this is compulsively focusing or obsessively, like over and over again, replaying the kind of same thought. That's what rumination is. So it's like when you can't, sometimes we call this racing thoughts. It's like you can't stop thinking about the one thing. And sometimes this is also fueled by what I call the neurotic's dilemma. Freud has these kind of three character types, and I know a lot of people shit on Freud, but he formed the basis for a lot of Western psychology, so we'll give him a little bit of a break. And I do like what he says about neurotics and this kind of obsessive kind of vigilance that always looking for some resolution to insecurity, right? Like, you may notice this in excessive planning is a form of rumination. I call it the to-do mind or the activity mind, the mind that's always like looking to kind of schedule things, create things, plan things, do things. It's a lot of just this kind of neurotic habit, and it's just a conditioned habit. It's like we're trying to maybe find some sense of like security or some type of alleviating distress by figuring out like what we're going to do. And so the problem, why it's the neurotic's dilemma, is because neuroticism is highly rewarded in our culture, hyperproductivity, and it's paid off, and it's actually, you know, can be really rewarding to be neurotic. But it's a quote I share very often here by Mark Twain. He said, the worst moments in my life never came true. Right? So much of our distress is a constant vigilance that's just never quite satiated. And so mindfulness helps us to look into these patterns and just to kind of, over time, clarify and understand the mind. And to see the mind not as my mind is this thing I need to identify with, but to see the mind as this kind of like these parts, the planning or the rumination, the obsession, the lawyer mind is analyzing everything and trying to make sense out of everything, the narrow mind that's hyper-focusing on just one aspect of experience. So I'd love to hear from you all. We've got some time for questions, comments, thoughts. Yeah, please.
So,